Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. The Freedom Food Alliance is out with a new report called the Disinformation Report, Harvesting Denial, Distractions, and Deception. The Freedom Food Alliance is a watchdog and advocacy organization working to cut through the noise in the global food industry. The report details how the meat and dairy industries use misinformation and disinformation to align public opinion with their financial incentives, influence policies, downplay the environmental impacts of the animal agriculture industry, and discredit plant-based diets. A few key findings: social media bots and astroturfing campaigns benefit animal agriculture with suspected links to lobbying groups, which have previously represented the tobacco industry and now represent the biggest meat companies in the world. A proposed high seas protection offered a potentially significant stride in ocean conservation, but scientists who fail to disclose industry funding, influence, and support bottom trawling are actively spreading misinformation to the public and in academic literature. Greenwashed versions of animal agriculture like regenerative ranching are being funded by the biggest oil and gas companies in an attempt to offset their impacts when the ranching industry cannot offset their own. The report says denial, derailment, delay, deflection, and distraction tactics are commonly used across various industries like tobacco, fossil fuels, chemicals, food and beverages, and plastics to undermine scientific consensus, change public perceptions, protect industry interests, and delay regulatory action. These strategies are aimed at sowing doubt, preserving the status quo, and diverting attention from the negative health, environmental, or social impacts of their products or practices. Understanding these tactics, says the report, is essential as we strive to facilitate a transition to a more sustainable food system. By reinforcing industry narratives, oversimplifying complex issues, and frequently promoting false or misleading information, the media and social media influencers often contribute to a skewed public perception of animal agriculture's impacts. Nicholas Carter is the lead author of the Disinformation Report and director of environmental science for the Game Changers Institute, an organization that promotes plant-forward nutrition in order to help improve personal performance, advance public health, support social justice, and protect the environment. He's also co-founder of PlantBasedData.org and a data scientist at Plant-Based News. Hi, Nicholas. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Kenny Torella is a staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect section with a focus on animal welfare and the future of meat. Kenny Torella is also the author of Meat Less, a Vox newsletter designed to help readers incorporate more plant-based foods into their diets. Hi, Kenny. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Good to be back. Thanks.
Great to have you. So I just want to ask you both a basic question, given that 93% of climate news never mentions meat, according to Sentient Media. We can talk about that later in the show. Nicholas, when you think about factory farming and how many animals are raised and killed for food consumption, things have wildly changed over the last 50 years. So can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of where we are today? How big is this industry?
Happy to, yes. Over the last 50 or so years, the industry has just grown exponentially. I mean, we now have about 4 billion farmed ruminants on the planet. And, you know, that's cattle, goat, sheep. And these are the ones that are particularly warming the planet. The latest IPCC report, AR6, showed that the increase in methane has direct correlations with some of the increase in farmed ruminants. So there's major implications to the climate. And of course, these animals take a lot of space too. So in terms of land, it's quite significant. I mean, now we have, for context, about, over 80% of all farmland is for animal agriculture. And just for perspective of how much kind of habitable land on the planet that takes up, it's almost half. So almost half of the habitable land that we have is now dedicated to raising animals. And I think an important point to kind of realize with that too is they don't perfectly efficiently you know, make meat. It requires a lot of feed, a lot of water. And of course, they're functioning animals. So a lot of the feed and water you end up feeding them, you don't get that same amount of meat back. So there's about a 90% to calorie loss during the production of animals. So it's a terribly inefficient way of having a food system. And that's kind of what led me to doing this analysis and then just uncovering some of the ways in which we're lied about this.
And to share a few more statistics, Kenny, you and your colleague Marina Bolotnikova had a piece just a few weeks ago called 9 Charts That Show U.S. Factory Farming Is Even Bigger Than You Realize. You report that in 2022, the most recent year with available data, the number of chickens, cows, pigs, and turkeys in the U.S. food system exceeded 10 billion for the first time in the census's history, up from 5 billion in 1987. That is hard to wrap your head around. 10 billion animals just in the United States.
It really is. That new USDA data showed that we really hit a huge milestone in the U.S. In surpassing the livestock population to now be over 10 billion. And we found a lot in that data. Most notably, if you look at the last 30 years, we've also seen the rise of what we're calling mega factory farms. So with kind of each passing decade, more and more animals are being raised on not only factory farms, but these massive factory farms that are kind of breaking their own records in size. You know, just as one example, it used to be the case that a mega chicken factory farm in, say, the 80s, early 90s had about 100,000 chickens a year. But now these mega factory farms can have about 500,000 chickens annually. And what this also means is that the number of small farmers has rapidly declined. So you have way more animals than we did just 30 years ago, but way fewer farmers, because the system has really become one in which if you don't go big, you know, you go home or you go out of business.
Well, that's the other thing I wanted to ask you, Kenny, and then Nicholas, if you have anything to add. What has really changed when you think about the small farmers? I mean, I grew up in Petaluma, which was known as the chicken capital of the world, and there just aren't that many farms that I remember growing up with. And so what has changed when you look at small farmers versus what you're calling these mega factory farms?
Yeah, so, you know, it used to be the case that 100 years ago, about a quarter of the American population was involved in agriculture in some way. And a lot of this was, you know, more small, informal farms where people were raising food for themselves and their towns. But over the last century, as factory farming has become the predominant, you know, mode of food animal production, what's happened is that many of these companies have become vertically integrated. So the largest meat processors, we'll take Tyson, for example. The way that they operate is that they're not just buying chickens from, you know, small farms here and there to add up to their whole supply. What they're doing is that they'll move into a particular area and recruit, you know, a few dozen farmers to build these massive warehouses. Long gone is the day of the small red barn, but now there's these vast metal warehouses where the farmer will, you know, own the land and own these barns, and then they'll contract out with Tyson in the same way that an Uber driver would contract with Uber. And Tyson will send them the chickens, they'll send them the feed, and then they raise the animals for Tyson in a contract model and then deliver those chickens to Tyson that then goes on to slaughter them. So increasingly, farmers are wholly dependent on these massive meat processors for their income. And in the contracts that they signed, it's often much more favorable to, you know, the Tyson Foods of the world rather than the smaller mid-sized farmer. And the industry, you know, kind of defends this model by saying that this is the most efficient way to make affordable protein. And it's true. Meat is generally cheaper than it's ever been and more abundant, but it comes at enormous cost to not only society, like these farmers that are going out of business, but also, you know, the environment and animal welfare.
Nicholas, what would you like to add about the changes we've seen from the small family farm to now these mega factory farms?
Yeah, I mean, like Kenny said, this is a story of corporate consolidation. And let me just share four main stats that that I've recently kind of found to encapsulate this kind of global picture of this. So four companies now control 99% of the global chicken breeding market.
Four companies,
that's it. Two supply almost all ducks. Four firms run 75% of the world's abattoirs or slaughterhouses and packing plants for beef. And four others control 70% of corporate pork slaughter. So very much this has been a story over the past few decades of consolidation. And, you know, this is a story that's not fully understood. A lot of it is hidden. And it's not that, you know, the intensification has, you know, all been impact. You know, one of the largest food and agriculture organizations, the FAO, they have long called for many decades for intensification, for environmental benefit. Of course, this has trade-offs. This has trade-offs of, you know, animal welfare is not quite as good. There's more risk of, zoonotic disease and pandemics. And, you know, people generally, of course, also just don't support factory farming. But I think one other just little anecdote I'll share here too is the story of extensive animal farming. In many cases, that would be worse, right? If we shift, all these animals out onto pasture, free range, you know, or whatever people believe that even exists, right? Then in many ways, that'll use far, far more land. So, there's not much way around it that whether you look at either intensification or kind of extensive animal farming, we need far less of it.
Can you talk about what really explains all of this? Reuters had a piece in October called Record Chicken Prices Squeeze U.S. Shoppers But Benefit Tyson Foods. And according to this piece, U.S. consumption of chicken is expected to exceed 100 pounds per person this year for the first time ever. And it made me think about Costco selling over 100 million chickens annually. They're less than about $5 a chicken. I also met a chef who works on a cruise ship, and he said that the cruise industry is radically changing the food industry. Because when you think about, I mean, we're going to do a show about the cruise industry because it's just getting bigger and bigger. But if you think about all those, say, 7,000 people on one ship, at any given meal, they have choices between chicken, hamburgers, bacon. I mean, it's nonstop. So what would you say has really shifted eating habits of people in the U.S. over the past couple decades, Nicholas?
I mean, chicken has been definitely one of the main things people are switching to for various reasons. I mean, some would be maybe for perceived health benefits. Some would be maybe for perceived environmental benefits. And of course, it's gotten a lot cheaper. And this corporate consolidation has made it abundant, right? And I think what's not well understood, just, you know, from my background as an environmental scientist, is yes, it has a lower carbon footprint than, say, beef or pork, but it's still three times higher than even the highest emitting plant protein, like, say, soy, and almost 10 times higher than peas. So in terms of environmental footprint, it's still not our best option. There's still an immense amount of waste. If you take 100 calories and feed it to chickens, you still only get about 12 back. So there's almost about a 90% loss still when you're trying to quickly grow a chicken, to then serve it as meat. But I think, you know, in my environmental analysis, a kind of like a bigger picture when it comes to chicken that is, you know, the biggest issue to me is the potential risk of zoonotic diseases. You know, these are, you know, upwards of tens of hundreds of thousands of chickens in one barn, and the potential for zoonotic diseases and the risk here is quite high. And of course, we have like an ongoing, you know, bird flu epidemic happening now, which has mostly escaped human impacts. But it wouldn't take a whole lot for that to jump potentially in the future. So I think that's a real risk that we should be considering when thinking that chicken is a good source to, you know, feed the world.
Kenny, what would you add?
You know, one thing I would add is that you know, when we think of the American diet, you know, we think of a lot of meat, and, you know, we eat more meat and dairy than almost any country in the world. And I think there's a few reasons for that. But one of the ones that often, you know, is not included in this conversation is just how much agricultural policy has shaped how we eat. You know, we might think of our food preferences as those that we just purely chose ourselves, but agricultural policy has really shaped what's available in the American supermarket and at what price. And there's one term that I think explains so much of what we're talking about today, whether you're looking at the environmental pollution from factory farms, the animal welfare issues, some of the labor issues, you know, just looking at how dangerous it is to work in a slaughterhouse or factory farm. What kind of brings all these issues together is this concept of agricultural exceptionalism, in which agriculture, the agriculture industry, often plays by a different set of regulatory rules than other parts of the economy. So as just some quick examples, agriculture is totally exempt from the Animal Welfare Act. So farmed animals have no, you know, federal legal protections while they're alive on the farm. Factory farms are also largely exempt from the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. And these two landmark pieces of legislation have been really critical at cleaning up pollution from other industries like, you know, energy and manufacturing. But because factory farms are largely exempt from them, we have this incredible amount of, you know, pollution from factory farms that goes unchecked. And so in many ways, you know, the low price of meat and its, you know, absolute abundance in grocery stores and restaurant menus is in part, you know, so abundant and cheap because it's been unregulated, and all of a lot of the costs of production have been shifted onto society in one way or another. And so I think that's a critical part for listeners to understand of, you know, why the meat industry looks the way it does today.
Kenny Torella is a staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect section with a focus on animal welfare and the future of meat. Nicholas Carter is an environmental scientist and lead author of the Freedom Food Alliance's Disinformation Report. It details how the meat and dairy industries use misinformation to align public opinion with their financial incentives, influence policies, downplay the environmental impacts of the animal agriculture industry, and discredit plant-based diets. If you have a question or a comment for our guests, we'd love to hear from you. How have your dietary habits changed over the years? And what are your thoughts about what you hear in the media about the meat and dairy industries, especially when it comes to greenhouse gases from food production? Livestock accounts for more than 14% of all global emissions, with meat making up nearly 60% of greenhouse gases from food production. And yet, according to Sentient Media, only 93% of Climate News never even mentions the meat industry. So what are your thoughts about these issues? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. So Nicholas, given all of the work you've done, and we're going to dive into your report in a minute, why do you think that is the case, that given where we are right now with this climate crisis and emergency, that 93% of climate news in the United States and Europe does not mention meat?
Well, honestly, I don't fully know. I would just be speculating, to be honest. But I do feel like, you know, something about food is a lot different than, you know, other environmental impacts that people have or people see in society. You know, food is personal. Food is culture. Food is, you know, what we grew up eating. So it is a difficult topic to bring up. So whether that's politically or in media, these all have, you know, influences on, you know, support or not support for something. I do think that is changing. I do think it's becoming very clear that, our agricultural system as a whole needs to change. Like, we don't have a choice. We need to make changes to this in order to have a healthy, thriving society in the future. And, you know, we don't need to be calling for all or nothing approaches in this. So you know, I think that could be somewhat of a problematic way to approach this. I think, like Kenny mentioned, just, you know, avoiding to not include agriculture within, whether it's environmental policy or even health guidelines, does not make any sense at all. So I think it's absolutely something that we should address. And I think they've largely had a free pass for many, many decades. And if I could just kind of point to one part of the report, which I think we can get into a bit more, but one part that really stood out to me is, you know, JBS, the largest animal protein producer in the world, is able to escape about 90% of their emissions in terms of their net zero plan for 2040. And that's because they're part of, you know, scope three additions, which would be considered, you know, third party, deforestation, feed crops, things like that. So for the largest producer of animal source foods to be able to not account for 90% of the emissions in any sort of climate plan, that makes no sense to me. And that's not any sort of, you know, climate accountability that that we want going forward.
And just to elaborate on this a bit, as you report, JBS is the world's largest meat producer. This is not a company that is talked about on a regular basis. So we did a show about JBS a while back, but can you tell us more about this company, how big it is, how much influence it has?
I mean, it's absolutely incredible. I mean, just for context, at the end of last year, the CEO of JBS was... in an interview with the New York Times journalist. And this is because they have a controversial New York Stock Exchange listing that they're trying to do to open up markets for new investments. I mean, they're responsible for incredible amounts of deforestation, resource use, and the list goes on, as well as human and animal rights, really atrocities over many decades. But what I was particularly narrowing down on the report is, you know, the ways in which even the CEO and their PR campaign is disinforming and spreading kind of really just factual inaccuracies. It's very, very similar to the early decades of smoking and the nutrition impacts and how they're kind of trying to escape that. And it's very similar to decades past of oil and gas misinformation over time. You know, there's public record of this, you know, spreading of misinformation. And as we're looking at some of the lawsuits that are now happening to, you know, say Exxon, one of the largest oil and gas companies, you know, they've been lying about their impacts. They knew about the impacts of climate change many, many decades ago and actively disinformed about it. The exact same thing is happening now with the largest animal producer in the world. So I think everyone should be kind of aware of this.
Right. In fact, Kenny, your colleague at Vox, Jan Dutkowski, sorry if I'm botching these last names, but Jan wrote why New York is suing the world's biggest meat company. And this is about New York Attorney General Letitia James saying that JBS is misleading promises, serious enough to take the company to court. The lawsuit claims that JBS's claim about emissions reductions is unsubstantiated and unachievable.
That's right. Yeah. JBS for years had been saying it would, you know, achieve net zero emissions without providing, you know, proof as to how exactly it would do that. And, you know, significant claims require significant evidence. And after complaints from some legal groups, the National Advertising Division of the Better Business Bureau told JBS it should stop making these claims in its advertising. But, you know, that was a non-legally binding recommendation from this advertising board, and JBS didn't stick to it. And so what then happened was that New York State's Attorney General Letitia James is now suing JBS over what amounts to greenwashing. And JBS is not alone here. A lot of the largest meat and dairy companies have been making pretty bold claims about reducing their carbon footprint, but have little evidence to show for it. And there's been increasing, you know, pressure to reduce greenwashing in not only in oil and gas, but now in the meat sector as well.
Kenny, before we go to break, what are your thoughts about this Sentient Media report that found 93% of climate news never mentions meat?
So I would go so far as to say it's even a little worse than the kind of the headline figure there, because Sentient Media, I believe in their analysis, found that that remaining 7% that does talk about meat production and livestock in the context of climate change, found that a lot of that 7% coverage was really looking at how climate change affects farmers rather than how farmers affect climate change. And, you know, the media has really kind of gone soft on animal agriculture, you know, writ large when it comes to pollution, climate change, and other issues. And I think that happens for a few reasons. I think one, you know, climate environmental media has understandably been laser focused on fossil fuels. But that said, you know, animal agriculture globally is still upwards of 15 to 20% of greenhouse gas emissions. And so it's a pretty sizable chunk of emissions. So I do think that it really needs to be under more scrutiny and covered more. And why is that? I think it's, you know, a really complicated issue. And a lot of news outlets, I would actually say most news outlets, don't have anyone dedicated to writing about agriculture. They may have people, you know, dedicated to writing about the food industry, developing recipes, but there are very few journalists in the US and globally who focus on agricultural policy, whether it's, you know, from a climate perspective or other perspectives. And so it's just long been neglected. And I think that is in part because, it's also kind of benefits from what I mentioned earlier, agriculture exceptionalism. Agriculture has been able to become this, you know, continue to be a massive part of our economy, but with very little scrutiny from both regulators and the press. And I hope that begins to change. This is an issue that is really, really interesting and intersects with just about every part of life because we all eat. And I hope that we can see more journalists cover this issue in the years ahead.
Kenny Torella is a staff writer for Vox with a focus on animal welfare and the future of meat. Nicholas Carter is an environmental scientist and lead author of the Freedom Food Alliance's Disinformation Report, which details how the meat and dairy industries use misinformation to align public opinion with their financial incentives, influence policies, downplay the environmental impacts of the animal agriculture industry, and discredit plant-based diets. It is a long, detailed report. You can find a link as well as the other stories we're talking about today at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss new work by choreographer Robert Moses. New Legacies, One Act Dances offers a defiant response to the chilling effects of censorship across the country. You can see the performance this Friday through Sunday in San Francisco. And we'll also talk about Republican-sponsored book bans. On Wednesday, we'll be joined by professors Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, authors of Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about how the meat and dairy industries use disinformation to shape public opinion, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about what you hear in the media about these industries? Do you often hear reports about the connections between the climate crisis and these industries? And does it affect the choices you make? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Kenny Torella, who writes about these issues for Vox. Nicholas Carter is an environmental scientist and lead author of the Freedom Food Alliance's Disinformation Report. We have a number of callers on the line, so let's go to Sam in Corte Madera. Hi, Sam. Thanks for holding.
Thank you for having me. I'm sorry I'm sick, but I keep hearing this conversation and no one addresses what is probably the primary issue because it's so difficult and we don't want to conceive how would we justify accepting the fact that this planet is overpopulated with one species. It's the composition, it's not magical, it's not mythical, it's not Mother Nature, but the world formed itself based on a chemical, basically a chemical composition of balance. And when you throw that balance off, unless I'm totally mistaken, you put one chemical inside of another chemical, there's a change. And when you don't even look at, have any concept of how much or how little or overall what the effects are, but there is one constant. The world was established to sustain a certain level of population. And we've altered that. And we just won't, almost refuse to accept that that's the issue, because we have to face the problem of, well, how do we decide where the population is limited and how to limit it? And B, there's another group that says, wait a minute, as long as the population grows and I get to stay on top, I'll survive so I can make as much profit or money or stay in the leadership role as long as I want.
Well, Sam, thank you for the question. I hope you feel better. I looked this up because I always wonder what the population was, you know, 50 years ago, for example. So according to Worldometers, in 1970, we had 3.7 billion people on the planet. In 1990, 5.3 billion, and today just over 8 billion. So what are your thoughts on that, Nicholas? What about so many people on this planet? Sam says, could that be the real problem?
Yeah, I mean, I've grappled with this question quite a bit over the years, and I think there's a really valid point in the ecological limits we have on this planet. Now, I've changed my opinion on this topic quite a bit, and I think the data shows right now that our population is actually fallen. You know, the population growth has fallen to below 1% a year. Meanwhile, the population of farmed animals is increasing, and by 2050, according to the UN, world meat consumption is likely to be 120% greater than it was in 2000. So that's going to exponentially increase based on trends. Now, meanwhile, our human population, you know, the trends show about 9 billion people will probably peak at and then decline. And ultimately, if you want to, you know, believe that that is the biggest issue, the human population, ultimately the best, you know, ethical way of dealing with that is increasing access to family planning and education for all. And multiple data sets have shown this. I think one of the groups that have done the best job of kind of explaining this is a group called Project Drawdown. And they showed what happens when you increase education for all and family planning, and it increases human rights as well as people have less kids. Mm. So I think that's an ethical way of dealing with it. But I do think that ultimately, it's first an issue of the amount of animals we have on the planet and are killing every single year, 80 billion plus, you know, trillions of fish. And then, of course, there's ecological limits of consumption. You know, there's a disproportionate difference between rich countries of the world and how much they consume versus, you know, poorer countries. So I think that's related to this topic as well.
There's also an important report out from Oxfam. This came out in November. It found the richest 1% of the world's population produced as much carbon pollution in 2019 as the 5 billion people who made up the poorest two-thirds of humanity. So it's also so important to bring some context to this. It's not like we're all emitting the same amount of greenhouse gas emissions. Kenny, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think you're right, Rose, that by and large, you know, when you're looking at this on a per person basis, people in rich countries like the US, but, you know, also Europe, but then also people in middle income countries just eat far, far more amounts of meat and dairy than people in low income countries. I mean, just in the United States, we eat three times the global average. And so, yeah, I take the listener's point. But ultimately, you know, you can get to some really dark places when you start trying to tell people how many children to have or not to have, and what is a much more humane and ethical way of looking at this issue is, I think, what Nick mentioned, is that we have to increase access to family planning and education to help people lead better lives. And in regards to this issue in particular, we really need to both overhaul agricultural policy so we're not so reliant on on animal products in rich and middle-income countries, just in the same way that we're looking to decarbonize transportation and energy, we have to decarbonize the food system. And the most effective and easiest way to do that is to reduce the amount of meat and dairy we consume and increase plant-based food consumption.
Well, thanks again, Sam. We'll definitely keep talking about the issue you brought up. It's an important one and important to bring in facts and some context. Thank you. Let's go next to Greg in Redwood City. Hi, Greg.
Good morning. Thanks for the show. I just want to say, you know, consumption is one of the issues that I have with food. I'm a vegetarian for the last 15 years and have a very active lifestyle. And, you know, I'm 55 and, you know, run circles around a lot of people much younger than me. And it's really about diet and education. It's, being a vegetarian, I had to do the research to find out how to, you know, sustain my active lifestyle and my health. And there's just very little information out there that, you know, gives people the information they need to make informed decisions. Like, you know, even if you go and buy, you know, a great bag of spinach, that nutritional value of that is depleted day after day. So, you know, after like the second day, it's something like 80% of the nutritional value is gone. So when you eat that, your body's going to say, not enough, please eat more. And so we're stuffing our faces with more and more food that basically is just empty of nutrients. And our, you know, body is saying, you need more because I'm not getting the things I need to run, you know. And, you know, you go up and down the list of, you know, how you cook your food. And, you know, when it was harvested, and all these things make a huge difference in your health and in the bulk or the volume of food that you actually have to consume to feel satisfied. You know, like nuts, you know, people love roasted nuts, but the nutritional value of roasted nuts is like you're eating husk. You know, it's been totally, you know, roasted out of the nut. And so, you know, if you switch over to something like a walnut or a sprouted nut, you know, incredible difference in nutritional value. And, you know, you could eat a handful of sprouted nuts and, you know, literally have the energy to run your whole entire day just off of the protein that's in that. So I really have a problem with just the lack of information out there. And then it's actually pretty complicated to find out where... when the food was harvested and, you know, where it came from, like, you know, stuff that's coming in from Mexico, is it, you know, under the same rigors as, you know, our organic standards, you know, it is a maze. And I think that, you know, that environmental impact and that lack of information is affecting our environment and our health.
Greg, you make so many great points. Thank you. And I think we should do more shows to give people this information because you're so right. It's confusing out there. We're flooded with information. Nicholas, a study will come out one day saying, you know, eat more of this. And then a study will come out the next day and say, no, that study's wrong. Do the opposite. So it's pretty confusing out there. Given that you are a data scientist at Plant-Based News, what advice would you give people who want scientific information about what they are feeding themselves and their families?
Yeah, the media landscape with food in particular is incredibly confusing. I would say check the sources. Don't believe everything you see for the first time. You know, look for credible peer-reviewed sources and coverage of those. And then I think that's where you can start framing your opinion and don't hold it too tightly and change it with new information that comes. I do think there is now a shaping scientific consensus around this topic. Absolutely, the more someone shifts plant-based, that is the best thing you can do in food. I've even thought this intuitively when I first came to this topic about 10 years ago. You know, I thought eating local was the best thing we can do in terms of food. But as I kind of dove into the evidence there, I started kind of seeing, well, that's not quite what it is. And just kind of a mind-blowing stat that I'll share is, you know, you'd have to ship a kilo of dried peas roughly 100 times around the world before its greenhouse gases match those of a kilo of local beef. Huh. Right? So the transportation impact of food is very little. And, you know, 1% of beef's footprint comes from transportation. Now, that's not to say people shouldn't seek out, you know, local, you know, plant-based foods from farmers market. There's many ways, many reasons to do that, support the local economy, learn a bit more of where the food comes from and how it was grown. But absolutely, the best first thing you can do is, shift to plant-based diets. And so, I mean, these other topics you come, these headlines that you, that someone might run into, I would just really, you know, think twice before quickly believing it. And that's kind of what the misinformation report is about and why I created it, because there's so much fear mongering happening around, you know, claims of chemicals in foods and ingredients. You don't know what they mean, so automatically you should stay away from it. There's a lot of nuance that's missing in all that. And that's kind of why it was so important to write that, I think.
Well, thanks again, Greg. Great show idea. We should do more shows about all of the issues you raised. Thank you. Let's go next to Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. I called in when you had Dr. Greger on, and I asked about the studies about the carnivore diet and these saturated fats. People are eating coconut oil and lard and bacon, and they say they're good fats. And, you know, he said that the studies about those things are really not good science. And a lot of, and the question that I have is about these studies. The people I know who are following them are very alternative eaters. They were vegetarians usually a while back, and they've switched over to this kind of diet. And I wonder if the studies that are promoting carnivore diets are actually industry studies, or where are they coming from? Are they coming? They seem to be coming from some, you know, alternative people, not industry people. So I just wonder the source of them. I myself am a vegetarian, and I am a vegan pretty much, and I'm going to stay that way, and I'm that for many reasons, but. Some of my friends have changed, and I wonder about that. Thank you.
Thank you for the question, Judy. Nicholas, do you want to take that first?
I would just say there is an incredible amount of industry funding that is kind of creating doubt and delay in changes. And the carnivore diet would be, you know, an extreme case of this. But absolutely, you do kind of see that it is increasing. I mean, like Greger would have said before, it is based on just awful science. That's ultimately what that is on the nutrition side. But I want to just speak a little bit, just briefly, on the wider thing of what's happening here. You know, there's JBS, for example. We talked about JBS. JBS could come out with some marketing materials and talk about the benefits of meat. Or instead, they could partner with an academic institution, fund a lot of their work, fund some of the university, and produce studies. Some of it might be, you know, you can reduce methane by a few percent and show that the industry is doing their part, or it could be a health-related intervention. And that, in turn, the industry is finding, you know, creates those headlines, gets a lot more buzz, adds credibility. But ultimately, this is still industry pushing a narrative to delay changes away from their work. And I mean, that's what we found. I mean, there's a study that came out recently from Jennifer Jaquet and Vivica Morris, and that looked at exactly this happening at UC Davis with the CLEAR Center and University of Colorado AgNext. And these are both highly industry funded centers at the universities, and largely, you know, doing PR campaigns with an academic credibility to it, but ultimately just an extension of industry. So yeah, it is confusing. It's very frustrating.
Well, and to that point, and thank you again, Judy, I will get Kenny to respond in a minute, but a few of the key findings, and this is why it's so confusing for people, is you found that there are these social media bots and astroturfing campaigns benefiting animal ag with suspected links to lobbying groups, which have previously represented the tobacco industry. And now they represent the biggest meat companies in the world. So there's like a hashtag called Yes to Meat. You also found that when reports come out in, for example, The Lancet, all of a sudden the meat and dairy industry go into overdrive to say that, no, we don't know the science. It's not there yet. I mean, they did the same thing with tobacco. So can you tell us a bit more, Nicholas, about some of the major findings and then what would you say to listeners who have to navigate all of this?
Well, I think this is where, first of all, on the solution side, I think this is where governments can really step in and start critically analyzing and regulating disinformation and greenwashing that is happening. And we are seeing signs of that. The EU just announced a pretty major crackdown coming in the next couple of years on greenwashing happening with foods. And I think that's an incredibly optimistic sign and something I covered in the report. Yeah, one of the examples that happened about a year or so ago was exactly that. It was a highly credible 16-country analysis. There was 37 different world-leading scientists from diverse backgrounds, from health to environment, zoonotic disease, and so on. And what they were doing was helping to paint the picture of food in the Anthropocene, so food in the current era that we're in, and where we need to shift these national dietary guidelines in order to be both health promoting and environmentally promoting. And luckily, I mean, the things that are healthiest for us are also very environmentally promoting. So those are mutually beneficial. But what happened there is, you know, this was a multi-year study. And there was industry awareness of this happening. And ahead of it, we saw even the tracking of the 8.1 million tweets for this particular situation. A week before the launch, there was a whole yes to meat hashtag campaign to preemptively misinform before the report even came out. And we noticed that same type of tactic happening for the more recent protection of the high seas. I mean, who would not want to protect more of the sea and allow more marine animals to thrive? But ultimately, industry wants to continue, you know, pulling animals out of the ocean as stock. So that's what we also noticed, the same type of tactic ahead of time. There was all of a sudden industry-funded studies coming out saying bottom trawling is not as damaging as we thought, and marine protected areas actually don't quite work. And this is all just kind of a way to delay and create distraction. Ultimately, one positive sign is, like, we are noticing that there's a lot less full-on denial happening. Like, there's less industry narrative saying food or animal agriculture has zero impact on the environment. But I guess a problem with that is now there's different, more creative delay tactics and kind of false solutions, which can delay changes for many more decades. And that's exactly what we saw with smoking. And that's what we saw with plastic. And that's what we saw with fossil fuels. These things all kind of tie together. So ultimately, we know what to do from how we've addressed some previous issues before, some quite well. I mean, we've addressed asbestos quite well. We've addressed the ozone layer and aerosols quite well. But, you know, food is a bit of a more difficult one. Mm. And yeah.
And Kenny, we have just a couple minutes left. One listener says, why can't this become an election issue? And this goes back to the question around why so few media outlets focus on these issues. What can people do to ensure that this becomes more of an issue? Because what we're doing right now is not working. I mean, the CDC says 6 in 10 Americans live with at least one chronic disease, like heart disease, stroke, cancer, or diabetes. I mean, we are all affected by this. If not personally, our loved ones are dealing with these diseases.
Yeah, so I think the election and the political question is really important here. So if you look at efforts to reform the, you know, the animal agriculture industry, the meat and dairy industries, it's really tough to do so. One, at the federal level, a lot of members of Congress are farmers themselves, or they represent areas or states with high levels of meat and dairy production. And the agricultural lobby has a lot of money to throw around, and they do, and have a lot of influence on Capitol Hill. So that's one of the challenges. And that, you know, we can see that in a lot of different you know, challenges in society where industry might have outsized influence and can influence policy. But it's the same case at the state level. So when you try to pass a bill at the state level that with, you know, in regards to agriculture, to farming, it has to first go through the agricultural committee. That's often stacked by farmers or people who represent districts with lots of farmers. And farmers account for about just 1% of the U.S. population, and yet them and the companies they sell to, their animals to, have an incredible amount of both, you know, cultural influence, but also political influence. So that's one of the biggest challenges. However, one of the few bright spots in this is that when the issue of animal welfare on farms goes to the ballot, so when voters can directly vote on it, like in California, voters pretty much always say yes, they want to improve protections for animals. Now, the environmental aspect of meat production, it hasn't been on the ballot yet in California or other states, but we might see that down the road. But I think if we're going to make any progress on this issue, we first have to raise awareness about it. And I think, you know, part of the problem too is that the broader environmental community hasn't really embraced challenging this industry in the way that they have with fossil fuels. Hmm.
Kenny Torella is a staff writer for Vox with a focus on animal welfare and the future of meat. Nicholas Carter is an environmental scientist and lead author of the Freedom Food Alliance's Disinformation Report, which details how the meat and dairy industries use misinformation to align public opinion with their financial incentives. You can find Kenny's reports and Nicholas's report at yourcallradio.org. Kenny and Nicholas, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you,
Rose. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.